This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Stu Does America.
Get all the 2024 election updates you need with our free audio podcast series, State of the Race. It's available under the Stu Does America stream. Wherever you get your podcast, just subscribe to it. You'll get this show and you'll get State of the Race. We have a new one coming up, I think, on Friday. Be sure to check out the show on YouTube as well, youtube.com/Stu Does America. There you can get that. You can get our comedy videos. There's a whole section of those, so go check those out. Jeremy Shane is going to be here to explain how we can save our healthcare system. I'll break down last night's racist Iowa LSU game. But we're going to start by doing the war on Trump's money. And I think before we get to that, I want to kind of set the scene with maybe the most important thing happening right now in the entire election. This is something that people talk about, but I don't think they frame it that way that often. And I think it is incredibly important. And what that is the approach of RFK Jr. RFK Jr. kind of entered this race with the idea of, you know, kind of mixing things up. He was obviously on the Democratic side. He comes in with sort of a pre-built constituency with his sort of vaccine skeptic sort of views. And they pull from both the left and the right. And he said a lot of things that have appealed to people on the right. Obviously, the opposition to vaccine mandates is a big part of that. But also, he said stuff about the border that seems kind of on the conservative side. It seems like a newfound position of his. A couple other things that kind of anti-Ukraine war. There's obviously a sentiment of that on the right now. So he's been appealing to the right. And there was a question going in which way this would work. Will this pull from Trump? Will this pull from Biden? Let me give you a kind of state of where kind of a set the playing field of where we are right now. Here's where the polling stands in a three-way race between Biden, Trump and RFK Jr. Kennedy has been averaging close to 10% in polling from the Decision Desk average. Making him the highest polling third party candidate in the presidential race since businessman Ross Perot in 1992. In a five-way race, Jill Stein and Cornel West included, Kennedy also right around 10%. We've seen some polling that has shown a slight advantage for Joe Biden here over the months. Some that have showed it equal, no real pulling from either candidate. However, the majority of the polling is showing a slight pull from Joe Biden and helping Donald Trump. And that is interesting. Now, you know, RFK Jr. has started to qualify in states. His campaign said they have qualified for the ballot in North Carolina, one of the big swing states, one that, you know, Trump is probably a slight favorite in, but was a very, very close state in 2020 and will probably be pretty close in 2024 as well. And it's interesting that RFK Jr. seems to be doing things that indicate he's going to pull more from Biden going forward. His vice presidential pick was not, you know, some conservative stalwart or some, like, you know, at one point it was talked about that he might pick Rand Paul. Now, Paul was not interested in that. However, Rand Paul is the nominee for the VP. That's going to maybe indicate he's going more toward the right and trying to get those people. Instead, he took a left-wing environmental lawyer who went on stage on the acceptance speech and really talked about a bunch of left-wing platitudes the entire time. Now, to be clear, RFK Jr. is a liberal, a hardcore liberal. He is not a conservative. He is not. I mean, I have laid this out to you before. I don't need to do it again. I mean, just the climate stuff in and of itself. I could never vote for the guy. But I know some people have different views on that, and some really like some of his long-term held views. However, if he was reaching out to the right, it might be dangerous for Trump. It seems, though, he's going towards the left. Let me give you another example of this. This is CNN. It's RFK Jr. and talking to Aaron Burnett. And I will apologize in advance that we actually had to give you RFK Jr.'s voice because it's just impossible to listen to. But here it is.
But do you really believe that when people talk about the threat to democracy that Trump poses, do you really think that is an equal evil to Biden?
I can make the argument that President Biden is a much worse threat to democracy. And the reason for that is President Biden is the first candidate in history, the first president in history that has used the federal agencies to censor political speech, so to censor his opponent. I can say that because I just won a case in the Federal Court of Appeals and now before the Supreme Court. It shows that he started censoring not just me. 37 hours after he took the oath of office, he was censoring me. No president in the country has ever done that. The greatest threat to democracy is not somebody who questions election returns, but a president of the United States who used the power of his office to force the social media companies, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, to open a portal and give access to that portal to the FBI, to the CIA, to the IRS, to CISA, to NIH, to censor his political critics. President Biden, for the first president in history, used the secret, his power over the Secret Service, to deny Secret Service protection to one of his political opponents for political reasons. He's weaponizing the federal agencies. Those are really critical threats
Donald
to democracy.
Trump, of course.
And now he's back on the other side. Now he's going after seemingly conservatives. That's something that would appeal, I think, to conservative voters. Wait a minute, actually, someone admitting finally that Biden actually does a lot of this anti-democratic stuff. He didn't even mention stuff like the student loan debacle, the eviction moratorium, other unconstitutional things. And the reason, of course, RFK Jr. brings this up is because he was a victim of it specifically, right? Like, he was a victim of government censorship. Overall, though, I think we're leaning toward it hurting Biden more, and that's going to be a massive thing, because even if I don't think he's going to get 10% in the race when it comes down to it, but maybe he gets 5%, and if that breaks 3-2 in favor of Trump over Biden, that could really twist it either one way or the other. And look, Trump needs all the help he can get because everyone's coming after him, as we know. An expanded gag order has now been come down, laying down the law as Trump returns to the campaign trail. And I will say, they always say, like, laying down the law. I don't know. Is that true? Let me give you an example. Judge Juan Merchan, late Monday, expanded a gag order on the former president ahead of his hush money trial, which begins in less than 2 weeks following searing social media attacks by Trump against the case, prosecutors, legal system, and even the judge's daughter. Thanks to the expanded measure announced Monday, the family of Merchan and relatives of the Manhattan district attorney will be off limits. The gag order had previously prevented Trump making statements about witnesses, jurors, prosecutors, court staff, or the family members of prosecutors and court staff. Okay, so they keep saying they're giving these gag orders to him. But let me show you how Trump reacted to that. This is from Truth Social. I was just informed that another corrupt New York judge, Juan Merchan, gagged me so that I could not talk about the corruption and conflicts taking place in this courtroom with respect to a case that everyone, including the DA, felt that it should never have been brought. They can talk about me, but I can't talk about them. That sounds fair, doesn't it? This judge should be recused and the case should be thrown out. There has been virtually never been a more conflicted judge than this one. Election interference at its worst. And keep this up for a second, because he says, I cannot talk about the corruption and conflicts. However, the very first sentence of his post is, I was just informed that another corrupt New York judge, he's calling him corrupt. And then at the end, he says, there's never been a more conflicted judge. So in the post about the gag order, he's violating the gag order multiple times. He does not care. Now, I think constitutionally he's on sound footing here. And so there's a reason why he's doing this. I don't think you can gag a guy running for president from defending himself. I think this is insanity. But still, like, if this actually has any effect, how does he just keeps doing it. Like, they keep telling him he can't do it, and he does it anyway. And I think that's one of the reasons, of course, a lot of people really like Donald Trump. Now, Trump also had to post a $175 million bond in the New York civil fraud case. This, again, was presented as a giant win for Trump, which is fascinating because, I don't know, $175 million for highly questionable, never been used like this before in history. Yes, it's better than the $500 million he was supposed to pay. But, like, $175 million is a lot of money for this, for what they say he did, which normally might be a slap of the wrist and say, hey, make sure you correct this in the future. Yeah, you wrote down the square footage of your apartment wrong. I mean, $175 million, really? It's obviously insane and has been insane this entire time. And of course, this is what the focus of this entire monologue is about, is they're not just coming after Donald Trump and trying to put him in prison. They're trying to bankrupt the guy. They're trying to get him so he has not $1 left to his name. They know the wealth part of this is a big part of, you know, Trump's profile. And they know they can hurt him by going after what is really important to him, which is, of course, his business success. This is hurts not only his profile, but also makes it impossible for him to spend on his own candidacy. Really, really difficult. Now, there is one lotto ticket out there for Donald Trump. Which is, of course, Truth Social. Now, Truth Social is, we were just talking about him posting on this. They've gone through a long process to have, I'm not going to go through all the SPAC stuff, but basically there's a merger that leads to this company being able to go public. And now it is public and it's worth $8 billion or something. Now, no one's surprised to see Donald Trump involved in an $8 billion company, but is this real? Is Truth Social really an $8 billion company? Because if it's not, and this isn't going to last, it's going to be hard for him to get his money out. In theory, he has to wait about 6 months to get his money out. And that would shield him against all of these attacks. That's why it's important. But is this going to last? Is he going to be able to get this money out? It's possible he can get a waiver. We will see if that is true. But with Truth Social worth, supposedly about $8 billion, it depends, it's been going up and down wildly over the past few days. What is the state of this business? Is it really a $8 billion company? When you look at the details, it is really fascinating. I mean, legitimately fascinating. First of all, it might be an $8 billion company, but it's losing money at a pretty significant clip. Trump's Truth Social lost $58 million last year. Now, look, it's a tech company. Tech companies lose money all the time. I mean, how long did Uber lose money? How long did Netflix lose money? It's not that big of a deal, right? Not that big of a deal. The problem is when you zoom in a little bit, $58 million isn't that big of a deal. However, when you've got a company that only has revenues of $4.1 million, it becomes a little bit more significant. And the deeper you look into it, the shakier ground this seems to be on. Now, let me just give you some of the details on this, because I think we all kind of know that Truth Social hasn't been a runaway success, right? Like, it's not competing with these big other companies that are social media companies. You can say, well, all right, you got this big social media company. Of course, these things are worth billions of dollars. But look at the details here. The company's revenue, all of which comes from advertising on Truth Social, in the last quarter of the year amounted to $751,000. $751,000 for a quarter. That's down from $1 million in the previous quarter. So it's not going in the right direction. In contrast, Reddit made over $800 million in revenue last year, and Twitter generated $665 million in revenue ahead of its initial public offering in 2013. Notably, the Truth Social parent company paid nearly $40 million in interest expenses last year and had a $16 million operating loss. In the SEC filing, this is kind of a problem. The Truth Social accountants, again, not the mainstream media, not like, some liberal publication, but the Truth Social accountants said the losses, quote, raise substantial doubt about its ability to continue as an ongoing concern. Those are not exactly positive statements made by their own accountants here. Is this a house of cards? Like, where does this go from here? Now, to give you a sense of what this means, we're talking about an $8 billion company, supposedly. The revenue at $4 million is a tad concerning. Let me give you an example when I talk about delicious Mexican food. Mexican Sugar is a company here in Texas that has three locations of these restaurants. If you're in Texas and you want some good Mexican food, little upscale dining, delicious. Mexican Sugar is awesome. It's a great place. It made an estimated $11.26 million in revenue from three locations, meaning each location of a Mexican restaurant brought in $4 million a year. Trump's Truth Social is bringing in the same amount of revenue as one location of a Mexican restaurant, and it's worth $8 billion? Seems a little questionable. Looking closer, as of January, Facebook had 3 billion users worldwide. YouTube reached 2.4 billion. Instagram had 2 billion. And Twitter reached 372 million. The new financial statement didn't say how many users Truth Social has, an ominous sign. But the online analytics firm SimilarWeb estimated on its first day of public trading that Truth Social had roughly 277,000 U.S. visitors. Again, it's hard to compete with these big guys. I understand. A lot of people have tried to launch competing social media companies. It's really difficult to do, but that's kind of the point. If Trump is really going to pull out $3 or $4 billion out of this company that is going to shield him from all of these attacks, this is a very shaky foundation to pull that money from. And how long is this going to last? It dropped about 20% yesterday, seems to be up a little bit today. But the company is just not set up for mainstream financial success. And I think we all kind of know, look, Truth Social, it's there. I'm glad Trump has a place to speak his voice. He got censored all these times, but it's not exactly lighting the world on fire. Let's be honest about it. And you're not on it all the time, probably. It's not really breaking through as a mainstream social media to compete with, you know, stuff like Twitter. You know, like, it's just the truth of the matter, and it shows in the revenue and the user numbers. But, like, the way this company is constructed makes it even more difficult for it to become profitable. Let me just read these two paragraphs to you. Devin Nunes is the CEO. He's paid a $750,000 salary that is subject to increase to $1 million within 2 years, filings show. The company chief financial officer, Philip Wuhan, oh my God, the Wuhan virus, and chief operating officer, Andrew Northwall, are all paid about $350,000. These are normal executive salaries. Nunes, Wuhan, and Northwall also each received $600,000 retention bonuses this month. Dan Scavino Jr., Trump's White House social media director and an advisor to the 2024 presidential campaign, was also paid $240,000 last year. Through consulting agreement that listed him as an independent contractor of filing shows, he too will be given a $600,000 retention bonus. Why do I read those executive salaries? Why do I do that? Because those two paragraphs I just read you completely wipe out all of their annual revenue. All of it. That's $4.1 million I just read to you. Their entire annual revenue is wiped out by like five employees. This is not a company that is in a position necessarily to grow and thrive and be the fountain of legal defense that Donald Trump probably needs with all the crap he's going through. And I point this out, I mean, because if you're an investor, you may want to be concerned a little bit about that. But also, the fact that this is something that is going to be a focus of the left going forward. They're going to go after this setup. They're not going to just let this slide. And by the way, I'll give you this as well. This is, again, from the actual the accountants from the company, the Truth Social parent company. They also disclosed to regulators that the company has identified, quote, material weaknesses in its internal control over financial reporting when it prepared a previous financial statement for the first three quarters of 2023. As of Monday, Trump Media said these, quote, identified material weaknesses continue to exist. Now, my point here is not to sit here and bash Truth Social, to not tell you about how she, you can get that from 100 different places. My point is, this is a real area of concern. They're going to come after Donald Trump for this. And you wonder at this point, you know, with Elon sort of freeing Twitter or X, Trump having his account opened, can he go back there? Is it more beneficial for him to be speaking to the people, much more, many more people over on Twitter than staying on Truth Social? Now, it's difficult to do that right now. The thing just went public. He can't just, he's never going to leave Truth Social. But the question is, should he be posting also on Twitter to reach more people? At some point, likely he'll be able to sell his stock, and maybe that's the point he opens this up, because I do think it's important that he's reaching out more broadly to a larger audience as you get closer to the election. This is a, I will say, this is something to be nervous about. This is a catastrophe in the making, because as you've seen, they've come after him for all sorts of crap, half of which they're completely making up. This is a very strange situation. This is a company with the revenue of a Mexican restaurant that's worth $8 billion. That's not normal. And they are going to come after him and try to take even more of his money and get more of his close confidants caught up in endless legal battles. This is just to tell you that there are threats you know about and there are threats we haven't seen yet. There's still much more to come as they start the war on Trump's money. Protecting your wealth is important. Did we learn anything about that in this particular segment? When you have wealth, you want to make sure you're growing it all the time. As you get closer to your retirement, you may have an advisor, you got some money in the bank, you got some investments, and you want to make sure you're growing those investments as you get closer to a time where you're going to enjoy your family. You want to kind of step back from the day-to-day grind. But are you able to do that with while aligning your investment money with your values? You can with Constitution Wealth. They can help you build a solid investment plan because, you know, you got to retire someday. But you're also going to do this while reducing your investments in stuff like ESG and DEI and CEI. You can reduce your investments in woke corporations and in so doing help fight the culture war with your most powerful weapon, your money and your voice. This is your opportunity to help build the parallel economy because it's not just like, oh, I'm not going to buy a case of Bud Light. I'm going to buy another beer. That's helpful. It's a few bucks here, a few bucks there. Everything counts. Well, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars you have invested, your proxy voting rights being assigned to a company that is friendly to ESG. You don't want that. If you have over $250,000 or more in stock and bond investments and would like to reduce your exposure to woke companies, go to constitutionwealth.com/stew. constitutionwealth.com/stew. Protect not only your retirement, but also your integrity with Constitution Wealth. You may know Ozempic as the product making your favorite reality show participants slightly hotter, but there's a lot more to that story, and I want to bring in Jeremy Shane. He's the founder and CEO of Life for Health and author of a National Review article, Why Medicare Should Pay for Weight Loss Drugs. I will tweet out the link shortly. Be sure to check it out. Jeremy, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thank you, Stu. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I appreciate you doing this, and I will say, as a conservative, someone who wants limited government, less spending, your initial reaction to hearing we should be paying for anything more than we already do is wait a minute, no, I'm resisting. And especially when you're talking about weight loss drugs, like right off the bat, that seems like crazy to a conservative. However, you make the case pretty persuasively that this could be something that could actually benefit us. Can you lay it out for us?
I mean, I think long term, Stu, it is a tremendous money saver. And I started my before my business career, I worked for a conservative Republican president. So, you know, I come from that perspective as well. What's interesting about these drugs, you mentioned the, you know, it helps in thinness and reality TV stars and so on. But they really impact a whole range of different health conditions. They were designed for diabetes. They were then improved for obesity. But we find that they actually help with heart disease, with liver disease, with kidney disease, a whole range of metabolic conditions, energy conditions that really accumulate over the course of people's lives and become really, really disabling, generally amongst the Medicare population when people get older and they have multiple kinds of conditions. And so the opportunity basically to use these drugs at the right price to preclude that kind of progression into severe disability is not only a money saver from a conservative perspective, but it's really also a lifesaver. It's a life extender. You know, we used to live for, 72 years, and the last 7 years or so, 5 to 7 years, were spent in ill health. Nowadays, we could live a decade longer, but most of that additional time is spent facing and fighting chronic disease. And so that opportunity to compress the amount of time that we have to have chronic disease is a huge lifesaver, life improver, spur for economic growth, and will save money in Medicare over the long term.
And I think we underrate how central to our financial problems and, of course, our health problems as well, these chronic diseases are. I mean, how fundamental to the costs of Medicare itself are these chronic diseases? It's a massive part of it, isn't it?
It's huge, Stu. It's huge. You know, you think about Medicare as like a trillion-dollar expense, and actually most of that goes to hospital care and for doctors. About 15% is actually for drugs and medication. But almost all of that hospitalization care and doctor care is for people fighting late-stage chronic disease kinds of conditions. And so you've got, you know, about 50 million people, 55 million people who are in Medicare. About 10 to 15 million of those people constitute the vast majority of the amount of dollars that Medicare has to spend, because these disease conditions just accumulate and they require hospitalization. Obviously, they're a burden on partners or other caregivers or family members. They require hospitalizations. They require drugs. They're disabling kinds of conditions. People have to spend down the retirement savings. So about 70% of Medicare, so call it roughly $700 billion out of that $1 trillion, is spent on 30% of the Medicare recipients. And those are invariably people who have multiple chronic disease conditions.
It's really amazing. I mean, and we've seen some of these effects. Our own Pat Gray here at The Blaze has diabetes, took Mounjaro, is now off of insulin completely, and it's now, you know, now you're having to deal with those expenses going forward. There's a lot of promise here. Now, obviously, Medicare already covers this stuff for diabetes, and I think they just started for heart conditions, but they do not do for weight loss generally. And part of that is they are legally prohibited from doing that. Is that right? I mean, there has to be a change in the law for this to actually happen.
Well, yes and no. So, yes, they are prohibited from doing it. And this was something that was put in place actually when Medicare Part D was passed. And at the time, the weight loss drugs that were available on the market were very dicey in terms of their efficacy. They had a lot of side effects. And so basically at that point in time, Medicare was precluded from covering drugs solely for obesity. What's really interesting, since I wrote the article, is actually Medicare has decided to allow coverage of the weight loss formulations of the drugs for people who have heart disease or heart kinds of conditions. So they figured out a way to cover these drugs, but not explicitly for weight loss or to treat obesity. And I think that just goes to show, you know, how these drugs have efficacy well beyond weight loss. I mean, I think from my perspective, I think it's a little bit of a misnomer to call them weight loss drugs or anti-obesity drugs. That's what they're commonly known as. But really what they're fighting is what I call, or what's known as, metabolic syndrome, which is the combination of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, liver disease, kidney disease. Not everyone has all of those things, but they tend to co-occur together. And when they do, that's when you get this very disabling sort of, you know, later in life kinds of combination of health conditions.
Yeah, what's fascinating about the research on this stuff, it's also, there's some evidence that it may help with Alzheimer's later in life. There's evidence that it's helping with people's addictions, even things like gambling and alcoholism. And it really is fascinating, sort of a new frontier. And yeah, some people get skeptical over this stuff, and that's totally fine. But I, when you look at it past the health benefits, and that it should be everybody's choice what they decide to actually take. But when you look at it from beyond that and just look at the fiscal part of this, and this is what really caught me on this, is that we have basically two solutions. We have an unsustainable system as it is. And we could do one of two things as a country. We can, one, become fiscally responsible, and someone can stand up as a politician and say, you know what, we need to cut these programs. We need later retirement ages. We need to make this all make sense. That's option one. Option two is we come up with some series of miracle treatments that actually just wind up lowering the cost and helping people so that this isn't something going forward. And honestly, with this country and the way it's set up right now, the miracle seems like a much more likely pathway to success. I feel like that's the way. I mean, looking at it this way, this could really help cure long-term fiscal issues with these programs.
100%. And actually, your option two, Stu, is what's always worked through history, right? When cardiac and heart disease was increasing in the late 50s and early 60s, the way hospitals found enough beds is we solved tuberculosis. Hospitals used to have 25, 30% of their beds were reserved for tuberculosis patients. As soon as tuberculosis is saved with antibiotics and vaccines, well, we've got more capacity. And that's what's gonna happen here as well. Science always drives finance, not the other way around. And for the last 50 years in America, since the early 1970s, we've tried to use financial engineering to force better scientific outcomes. And it just never works. The only way to bend the cost curve down is to push the health span curve out. And what I mean by that is what I was saying earlier, which is increase the number of years that people live that they don't have chronic disease. And one of the reasons to do this also in Medicare is that I think we will find, you know, these drugs won't work for everybody. They'll work very well for some people. They'll work kind of well for others and not well for others. And that will also spur, you know, innovation in better and newer kinds of drugs, or drugs that might work especially well for older people. But What it will really drive to the essence of your question is we should be using these drugs and other interventions much, much earlier in life for people that are in their 40s and their 30s and their 50s to change the course of their likelihood to develop chronic disease and even the progress of their chronic disease. So that by the time they're 65, we don't have these issues. Like 30 years from now, if we do this right, we won't be needing to cover Medicare recipients for these anti-obesity drugs because we will have taken care of it 30, 40 years earlier. But we need to do this across the lifespan now to figure out who these drugs really work well in and not. And I think just one other thing I'll just throw out there is like, just because a drug company says, I want to get $6,000 a year for this drug, which is, you know, sort of the going rate right now for some of these drugs, that doesn't mean that's what the federal government has to pay. There are all sorts of models we saw in Operation Warp Speed and others where the government can try and incentivize the building of productive capability here in the United States so that these are homegrown medications. We could potentially export them later and get a massive discount from the drug companies in exchange for that commitment, to buy at volume. And that's a way that we can save a lot more in Medicare and what we actually have to spend, make sure we've got sufficient supply, and really learn a lot about who these drugs work well for or not.
I think it's true, and I think it's part of a larger approach. I've really enjoyed Peter Attia's book, Outlive, which is out, and I know you've written about it. And his idea is basically attacking these things a lot earlier. I think we've been so reactive in healthcare, where we've been thinking of these things as, okay, well, you got diabetes, it's looking really bad, here's some drug to maybe extend your life a few months. And we're spending thousands and thousands of dollars there instead of thinking a little bit earlier and trying to get ahead of these things. Is there just a rethinking of the way we approach medicine overall that will really help this long term?
Absolutely. And I am a fan of Peter Attia's books, and there are others. I think what there is a chasm between the great ideas that Attia and others have about how should we live in an ideal world and good food and nutrition. And I endorse all those things. And I think those are great. But how do we do that really systemically? And actually, you know, what I'm working on, what Life for Health is basically an idea of using life insurance instead of health insurance to underwrite much earlier investment in chronic disease care and basically end chronic disease. Because what it comes down to is we need to invest earlier and decisively, help people maintain those gains over time. And again, so that when they get into their older years, they have more years of great health and fewer years of significant disabilities, fewer years of cancer risk, fewer years of Alzheimer's risk. But that work has to be done in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And, you know, right now in health insurance, we all change, or our employer changes coverage from year to year. Health insurance is not designed to deal with these long-term, long-range kinds of issues. You know, we need a different sort of financing paradigm underneath it. And I think actually life insurance offers a better kind of long-term relationship than health insurance.
I'd love to have you back on at some point to talk a little bit more. I feel like Rand Paul at some point flirted with an idea like this that was, I think, a really interesting approach to insurance overall. I'd love to have you back on. Jeremy Shane, he's the founder and CEO of Life for Health. Be sure to check out his article in National Review, Why Medicare Should Pay for Weight Loss Drugs. Jeremy, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thank you, Stu. This was great. I look forward to it.
We were just talking about our medical system, and, you know, I think we got a little comfortable in the United States thinking like, okay, we're the United States. We're always going to have access to everything we need. And then we saw COVID happen and supply chain issues happen. Even now, as of March, there are more than 200 drug shortages in the United States, and it could get a lot worse before it's going to get better. A lot of experts are pointing to shortages in domestic production. There's the Drug Supply Chain Security Act. That's something that we're going to be talking about, I think, more and more over the next couple of years. You wouldn't think that things like this could happen here, but we have seen it for years now, and that's why we always talk about the Jace case. It provides 5 life-saving antibiotics for emergency use. All you have to do is fill out a simple form online, and you will have it ready for you in case you need it. Whether you're traveling and you need it, you don't want to deal with some of these healthcare systems in other countries. They can be nightmares. And if it's something basic, you should be able to knock it out easily without some sort of shortage putting you in the hospital or something. There's all sorts of add-on options as well. So check it out, Jace. Medical is empowering people just like you to be able to take care of your family's health and take it into your own hands. You can check them out today at jacemedical.com. Enter the code STU at checkout for a discount on your order. The promo code is STU at jacemedical.com, J-A-S-E medical.com. Well, there's a big game last night in, well, there's a couple of them, actually, in the women's Elite Eight, leading to the Final Four between LSU and Iowa. That was the kind of the big rematch of the finals last year. Before the game, LSU, however, did not get out there for the national anthem. Watch. Something's missing. Now, a quick question for you. Do I have to stand and put my hand over my heart when we're watching a clip of the national anthem? I don't know. I feel weird just sitting here. Anyway, so they didn't show up to the national anthem. Now, they did say afterwards, the LSU coach said the team's absence during the national anthem was not intentional. So we will, I mean, who knows if you believe them or not. They just said their routine. This is when they normally come out. They missed it. I don't know if that's true or not. I definitely have my doubts. Caitlin Clark did wind up winning the game with Iowa. We talked about it yesterday. Jill Savage apparently has all of her capacities. She was very nervous about this. But they won and looked really good doing it. Over was it 40 or 41 points for Caitlin Clark in that game. 41 points, 12 assists, 7 rebounds. There it is. 102-85 was the victory. Now, of course, you can't have Caitlin Clark win a game. We can't just be excited that there's a college star who's really changing the entire sport and the way it's played. No, we have to talk about, you guessed it, racism. Mm-hmm, because she's white, and we're not allowed to cheer for white people. Obviously, they've been oppressing everyone forever, and so they're all evil and racist. Jemele Hill, she says she complained about Caitlin Clark receiving more coverage than black players. And as one thing we can say, I know there's a lot of divisive issues, but one of the probably things we can all agree on is that black players have never been covered playing basketball. That's just one of those things. I mean, people will not talk about black basketball players. It's a real problem with our media. No one's ever, I can't think of one example of any black basketball player that has ever been praised universally and constantly every single day for multiple decades. That's certainly, there's no examples of it whatsoever. So really on the nose coverage from Jemele Hill as usual. And I really think like there's no reason to dislike Caitlin Clark other than her skin color, right? Like she seems to be very normal. She seems to be incredibly talented. She's changing the way basketball gets played. And I gotta say, you know, like as a guy whose main interest in women's sports is solely my daughter's gymnastics meets. Outside of that and Caitlin Clark, I don't care at all. Some tennis. I like some of the women's tennis. That's I can deal with that. But outside of that, I don't care at all. Caitlin Clark getting me interested is a big deal. And watching the other players who looked a lot like old school women's basketball players, including Angel Reese, who looks like a clumsy Manute Bol out there on the court, I don't even get it. She's something different. And the fact that people are getting interested should be a positive for women's basketball. Instead, her skin color makes it a negative to people like Jemele Hill, which is amazing. And I will say, Caitlin Clark took the high road after being taunted last year and trash-talked after losing to LSU by Angel Reese. She didn't return the favor. She was very nice and complimentary afterwards, and that's exactly what she should do. She took the high road. That's the right thing. Of course, LSU's Angel Reese opens up afterward, getting the positive, oppressed coverage once again. She opens up about dealing with hateful speech, death threats. I've been through so much. I mean, it is a tragic existence to make a bunch of money and, go and play in the Final Four or the Elite Eight or the National Championship game and be praised by people like Jemele Hill and almost everybody in mainstream media. Look, no one should get death threats. That shouldn't happen at all, of course. In the age of the internet, we all know it happens way too often by lunatics. Maybe she actually got them. I don't know. I mean, I don't know why anyone would care enough to threaten someone. Hey, I don't like you unless you play women's college basketball. Maybe there's somebody out there who thinks that way. But, like, you know, she's been trash-talking everybody this entire time. Like, the fact that now that you lost and now you're the victim of it, you don't have to take any of the trash-talking. You just wind up being get the wonderful, positive, oppressed coverage because of your skin tone. Well, by the way, there's plenty of African-American players on Iowa and other parts, other teams. In fact, the other rising star happens to also be black. It's just not Angel Reese. It's Juju Watkins. It's just, it's infuriating that we have to go this way every single time, but you live in America, it's 2024, and I hate to break it to you, we have to go down this road every single time. I've been telling you for a while about the Gen 90 and the latest breakthroughs from skincare technology from our friends over at GenuCell. It's the best in skincare. Well, did you know it also works on those annoying bags and puffiness under your eyes instantly reducing the appearance of looking older anywhere you use it, around the eyes, the forehead, the crow's feet, the laugh lines, even the chin. Never worry about your skin or your confidence again because Gen 90 technology is here. It's got luxurious, paraben-free, silky smooth, and best of all, it starts working in seconds. And now you can get GenuCell's classic under-eye bags and puffiness serum with every Gen 90 order and their luxurious GenuCell XV collagen builder moisturizer with vitamin C and hyaluronic acid in a pure natural base. These are stunning results you'll get day after day from our friends at GenuCell. GenuCell.com. Right now, you get incredible packages, over 50% off during GenuCell's spring sale. Results are guaranteed or your money back. Go to GenuCell.com/Stu, GenuCell.com/Stu. Right now, you can order and get a free limited edition spa box with bonus gifts and free shipping. It's GenuCell.com/Stu, GenuCell.com/Stu. All right, I've got three stories I want to get to in like less than 2 minutes to get to it. So let me get right away on to a pre-cancellation alert for J.K. Rowling. Now, she's kind of been canceled about 1,500 times already, so I don't know if this is a real pre-cancellation alert. And she might be too important to culture to be canceled, although many have said that before. But J.K. Rowling dares cops to arrest her for misgendering trans people after new woke hate crime law. This is going on, and a fascinating thing because they could actually arrest her for her just saying men or women are women, which is something she's been sticking to despite all the pressures. You know, the ultimate FU money comes from J.K. Rowling. She does not care from that perspective. But she's put in prison. She's put in prison. We will see if that happens. And also Shakira, pre-cancellation alert for Shakira. She said her sons hated Barbie because it is emasculating, and she agrees. I like pop culture that empowers women without robbing men of their possibility to be men. Oh my gosh, she is toast. She is absolutely toast. And I don't know, maybe Disney's toast too, because they continue to make really bad decisions, including losing $134 million on Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. But that includes $80 million in post-production to de-age Harrison Ford. So in reality, it only lost $54 million if Harrison Ford were just magically younger. And by the way, if you're going to de-age Harrison Ford, shouldn't you also de-age his voice? That's just a recommendation from me, because I refuse to see the movie, but everything that I saw about it seemed to have a younger-looking guy with a very old person's voice, and that doesn't make any sense whatsoever, nor does anything else Disney is doing these days. Okay, so here's what happened. Punxsutawney Phil and partner Phyllis welcome two baby groundhogs. Now, there's multiple things. First of all I can think about is Groundhog Day. I just can't think of anything other than, you know, Bill Murray waking up and hearing the same recording of the radio show after I Got You, Babe. But why are we referring to Phyllis Punxsutawney Phyllis, apparently, which is a thing, as Phil's partner? Like, are they not married? Is it not she had the groundhog babies. It has to be a woman. And I hate to tell you, that's the factual part of this. Maybe they're just hookups. I don't know. But Punxsutawney Phil and a partner have babies. Here's a picture of the, you know, the guy very excited, smiling with Punxsutawney Phil and Phyllis in the background and the babies there. I will say, I suggest a succession-like reality show for who takes over the gig of weathercaster. Like, we have a fight to the death, and whatever Groundhog wins gets to take over the gig. I don't know. It's just a recommendation. I'd watch it.